short recess. We will admit 9 attorneys from Marquette University Law School who have graduated, fulfilled all the requirements, and will be admitted to the bar to be lawyers. So we'd like you to stay and listen to that. And then after that's completed, Justice John Wilcox will speak with you. That's the program for the lunch hour. Anyone else who wishes to listen to Justice Wilcox and the students are welcome to do that. And so before I proceed, let me introduce the bench to you all now that we've met the Wisconsin Heights High School students. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, with whom you'll be meeting. And to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. So with those housekeeping matters taken care of, we'll call 98-1821-FT, and I'll let Ms. Boyer Ryan, representing American Family Mutual Insurance Company, tell us how the plaintiff's name is pronounced.
I'm going to guess at that myself.
Okay, well, we may have to wait for Mr. Elliott. Mr. Elliott, face COVID. Thank you.
May it please the court, Beth Boyer Ryan, appearing on behalf of American Family Mutual Insurance Company and American Standard Insurance Company in Wisconsin. Also appearing at council table is Carmela Puglisi, an attorney with American Family's Milwaukee Legal Department. An insurance policy exclusion is permitted unless it is prohibited. This court in Clark versus American Family set forth the analysis to determine the validity of an insurance policy exclusion. The analysis was based on Wisconsin Statute Section 632.32, which states that a policy may provide for exclusions which are not prohibited by subsection 6 or other applicable law. The legislative intent of 5E is clear. Insurance policies are permitted unless prohibited. In applying the court's analysis in Clark, two questions must first be asked. First, is the exclusion prohibited by subsection 6? And second, is the exclusion prohibited by other applicable law? If the answer to both questions is no, the exclusion is valid. The policy exclusion in this case is titled Endorsement 44 and states as follows. The insurance provided by this policy under Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, Part 4, Part 5, or underinsured motorist coverage shall not apply to Blazikovic Monica when using non-owned emergency-type vehicles in connection with her employment, occupation, or profession. American Family issued two policies of insurance to Ms. Blazikovic. Both covered her personal autos. It was clear that the fire truck that she was occupying when she was involved in the accident was not covered. Endorsement 44 was attached to both policies. When this accident occurred, Ms. Blazikovic was a City of Milwaukee firefighter. The fire engine she was occupying attempted to make a left turn in an intersection and was struck by an uninsured motorist.
Can I ask you a question about endorsement 44?
Yes.
Was that standard in all the policies, or did you pick when they were law enforcement officers or firefighters?
Yes, it is. I've seen many policies issued by American Family. It is not standard. The question must be asked of the insured when they are seeking insurance, what is your occupation? And it is my assumption that it is applied only when someone is involved in a high-risk occupation, such as a firefighter or police officer.
And that was issued when the policy was issued?
Her policies were issued 1993. Apparently, her family had insurance back with American Family back in 1980. She then obtained her own policies. Both were at least a few years before this accident occurred. She had policies with American Family and it's my belief the endorsement 44 was attached to both policies at the inception of her obtaining insurance.
That was before the Act 21 of 95.
Yes.
Excuse me. I want to clarify this. Was there a policy in place before August 25th, 1995, that didn't have this 44?
No, her policies back in 1993 had the endorsement attached to it. And yes, at the time that the policy was issued, I would certainly agree endorsement 44 was not valid at that time. However, endorsement 44, it is my argument, became valid in July of 1995 with the act, when Act 21 was enacted, and that was a month before the accident occurred.
There's a void provision, and your position is it's been invalidated by the legislature.
Correct. And it is my understanding that American Family does not have to provide notice to the insured when the law changes, as long as the law changes as a result of a legislative or judicial act. We would have to provide notice to the insured when a policy is changed on less favorable terms, only when it's the insurer making such changes.
Well, the material in the appendix here talks about this endorsement being effective 8/25/95. At least one of them. One of them is 8/24/95. 8/25/95 was the actual date of the accident, wasn't it?
Correct. It was in force at the time the accident occurred, but it had been a part of her policy since she obtained insurance with American Family years before.
Well, was this document sent to her? Or was there some additional notice sent to her?
There would be no additional notice sent to her regarding whether there was any change as to the validity of endorsement 44.
A document that says effective date, 8/25/95, is that an internal document for the insurance company? Or did she know about it?
Is your question, did she know about endorsement 44?
Yes.
Yes. There has been no argument at all that she did not have notice of endorsement 44. Both counsel and I agree that endorsement 44 is clear and ambiguous. There's been no issue as to notice provided to the insured.
But would you concede that on July 13th, 1995, that was not valid?
Yes. Endorsement 44 was not valid prior to July 15th of 1995.
On the basis of?
Welch versus State Farm and Neiman versus Badger Mutual, which are no longer good law. When the Clark analysis applied, you have to look at two things. First is the exclusion prohibited by subsection 6. There is no doubt subsection 6 does not apply in this case. The next question, though, is what is other applicable law? And in this case, other applicable law should be case law or statutes, just as the court in Clark broke down what is other applicable law to be case law or statutes. There is no case law anymore in Wisconsin that would prohibit endorsement 44. This court in Clark noted that there were many cases that previously invalidated UM exclusions, but those cases have been overturned by the enactment of Act 21, which created numerous statutory provisions validating anti-stacking clauses, reducing clauses, and drive other car exclusions. Since Clark was decided in March of 1998, courts have reiterated the fact that case law has been overturned. This court in Hull versus State Farm noted that case law had been overturned because of the legislative changes of Act 21. The Court of Appeals in Rowell versus American Family stated that Welch versus State Farm and Rohde versus Stoner were overturned by the creation of which stats section 632.32.5J. And even in this case, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that the sweeping legislative changes under Act 21 overturned previous case law. There's no case law anymore to invalidate endorsement 44. The only question then remaining is, are there any statutes that invalidate endorsement 44? There are no explicit, there's no statute that explicitly states endorsement 44 is overturned, is invalid. However, the Court of Appeals in this case stated that WSSTAT section 632.32.5J invalidated endorsement 44. In a nutshell, 5J states that a policy may include an exclusion if it meets all the following conditions. It must be an owned vehicle. It must not be described in the policy of insurance under which the claim is made. And it must not be defined in the policy as a newly acquired or replacement vehicle. The Court of Appeals held that since endorsement 44 did not meet the rigorous requirements of 5J, it's invalid. They reasoned that the legislature, in drafting 5J, knew of the existence of case law, such as Neiman versus Badger Mutual, which held regular use exclusions invalid. And therefore, if they intended to validate regular use exclusions, they would have expressly stated so. They implied that endorsement 44 is a regular use exclusion, and they concluded that the legislature intended to continue the prohibition of regular use exclusions. Their holding and analysis is erroneous for several reasons. First, Neiman is no longer good law. This court in Clark stated that Neiman was overturned by Act 21. Even if this court had not stated that Neiman was overturned, the rationale applied by the court in Neiman is no longer good law. The Court of Appeals simply applied the Welch rationale that once a person purchases UM coverage, they have it under all circumstances. That is no longer good law. There should be no argument that Welch is overturned. Therefore, Neiman, just on the facts, regular use exclusion, stating that the regular use exclusion is invalid because once you purchase UM insurance, you have it under all circumstances, it's no longer good rationale. Third, endorsement 44 is not a regular use exclusion. The rationale behind an insurer using a regular use exclusion is based on frequency.
I'm sorry, using a what kind?
A regular use exclusion.
Regular use.
An insurer does not want an individual, an insured, driving a car all the time and not insuring it, but then expecting to provide coverage for that vehicle from another auto that they purchased that they did insure. So the purpose there is regular use, frequency, how often they drive it. Endorsement 44 has nothing to do with frequency. American Family has just chosen not to insure a high-risk vehicle. And in this accident, the vehicle is making a left-hand turn in an intersection and is struck by another car. Those are high-risk situations. Just as insurers choose not to insure Porsches or other types of high-performance vehicles, they chose not to insure fire trucks or police cars. Therefore, the rationale between a regular use exclusion and endorsement 44 is completely separate. So even if Neiman was still good law, it shouldn't be this umbrella of any type of exclusion that doesn't involve an owned car is under the umbrella of a regular use exclusion. There's many different types of exclusions. But really the crux of why the Court of Appeals analysis is incorrect is because they did not discern the intent of the legislature in enacting 5J. There's been quite a bit of confusion as to the scope of 5J. What does 5J apply to? 5J does not state that it only applies or governs driver the car exclusion. As a matter of fact, the term driver the car exclusion is found nowhere in the wording of 5J. UM exclusions also aren't mentioned within 5J. However, if you look at the other five statutory provisions created by Act 21 under subsection 5, F pretty much states all coverages, G deals with uninsured or underinsured, H deals with medical payments, I is uninsured, underinsured, and you go back to J, that doesn't make any reference to what type of coverage it applies to. However, the Court of Appeals just makes this assumption. We're talking about driverless car exclusions, and we're talking about UM exclusions. They never went to legislative history. No idea where they got that from. Now, Mr. Elliott, to clear up some of the confusion, attached the Legislative Reference Bureau's analysis of 5J. It states, the bill validates certain drive other car exclusions which courts invalidated when used to prevent stacking. The important language there is which courts have invalidated. Endorsement 44 has never been invalidated by a court based on the fact that it attempted to prevent stacking. It is clear that the legislature in enacting 5J was merely trying to validate all the drive other car exclusions which courts had previously invalidated. Why doesn't it address liability exclusions? Because liability regular use exclusions have been held valid by this court and other courts. This really does only apply to UM exclusions that have been held invalid.
How does 5J differ from the list of prohibitions in 6?
5J is a permissible provision. It's 5 deals with all the permissible provisions, and J, 6 deals with all the prohibited provisions. That's why if you interpret 5J as only applying to one fact situation, and unless an exclusion meets only those criteria, it's invalid, that's more of a prohibited provision than a permissible provision. Because you're dealing with punitive damages exclusions, intentional act exclusions, many exclusions under the liability section of a policy, when applied strictly to the conditions set forth in 5J, they will be invalid. And therefore, the Court of Appeals analysis, while they avoided that whole, you know, any type of exclusion can be applicable or can be governed 5J, it will lead to absurd results.
This is what I don't understand. If 6 lists all of the prohibited prohibitions, doesn't that render 5J somewhat analogous? Isn't there an implication if 6 lists all prohibitions, everything else is permissible? So why have 5J as a permissible, setting forth what's permissible?
If the legislature intended to prohibit driver the car exclusions, it is my argument they would have stuck that under subsection 6. 5E states it is permitted unless prohibited. So obviously you have to go to subsection 6 that sets forth you cannot do this, you cannot do that. But if you look at the 5 statutory provisions that were created by Act 21, 5F, G, H, I, and J, all of them validate previously invalidated insurance clauses or exclusions. It's a scheme that works together.
Then, assist me if you will, explain again the purpose of enacting 5J and explain and document for me the authority for citing the purpose.
5J addresses certain driver the car exclusion scenarios. If you look at 5F, 5F deals with cases which this court even noted in Welch, situations in which an insured owns 5 vehicles, they insure all 5 vehicles. But under 5F, you can only get 1 policy of insurance. There's no more stacking.
F is the Welch policy.
Yes. 5J addresses a whole different scenario. 5J addresses situations in which an insured owns 5 cars, they insure 1. They happen to become involved in an accident in one of the uninsured cars, and they want to look to the policy of insurance that they had on another vehicle they weren't driving for coverage. They no longer can do that. If you now are in an accident in an uninsured car, you get 0 coverage. If 5J had not been drafted at all, then there's many scenarios where people could continue to own many cars, insure 1, and still obtain coverage for any car they drive. So 5J does serve a very important purpose.
Why isn't the purpose of 5J, can't it be incorporated into 6? Prohibited practice.
Because there's
prohibited
nothing
provisions.
There's nothing prohibited at all about 5J. 5J states, you can do this, and it must meet all these conditions. And it's been argued, well, then those are the only conditions in which a driver-of-the-car exclusion is going to be valid. That's one exclusion that's going to be valid because that occurred in many cases. Parks versus Walpole case is a perfect example. In Parks, the gentleman, plaintiff, was driving an uninsured motorcycle that he owned. He then looked to other cars that he owned and insured and said, I need to stack those. And he obtained coverage. Under 5J now, he does not obtain any coverage because he's an uninsured car. Therefore, under criteria one, it's an owned vehicle. Two, it's not described in the policy. It's not a newly acquired vehicle. No coverage. 5J permits the insurance company finally to do these things it couldn't do in the past. But endorsement 44 was merely invalidated because of rationale applied in Welch and other case law that said once you purchase this coverage, you have it under all circumstances. No courts ever looked at endorsement 44 and said this violates 631.43.1 or 632.32.4a, the two statutes that the courts always relied upon to invalidate UM exclusions. So if this court is to hold, as did the Court of Appeals, that unless the legislature specifically permits an exclusion, it is prohibited, then 5E is completely rendered superfluous. 5E states an exclusion is permitted unless prohibited. 5E alleviates the need for the legislature to specifically enumerate every single insurance clause or exclusion which is valid. They don't need to do that. What they need to do is state what is prohibited. 5J doesn't state anything is prohibited. 5J doesn't state it only applies to driver of the car exclusions. Doesn't say it only applies to UM. But the Legislative Reference Bureau's analysis states this was intended to validate previously invalidated driver of the car exclusions.
Ms. Blair Ryan, let me ask you a question. Centering on a case that you discuss in your brief, the Vidmar case, what do you think of and how do you answer this argument? Vidmar looked at a predecessor to endorsement 44 and basically found that that predecessor endorsement was invalid. When I look at footnotes 3 and 4 in Clark, I find no mention of Vidmar being overturned. Isn't that significant?
It is not, because the issue in the previous Vidmar case was whether UM coverage was one of the categories of insurance that was intended to be precluded under endorsement 44. And this court said endorsement 44 is ambiguous. Endorsement 44 really only applies to liability coverage, not UM. So this court never even addressed the validation of endorsement 44 as excluding UM coverage. I believe only in the concurrence the Chief Judge, Justice, mentioned that had endorsement 44 been properly worded and excluded UM coverage, it would still be invalid because I believe under 632.32.4a or 631.43.1. But the court never even got to that issue. They said, we read it, it's ambiguous, it only applies to liability insurance, and I believe the court held that endorsement 44 was valid to preclude liability coverage. It just wasn't sufficiently worded to preclude UM coverage.
No, it's been reworded, obviously.
American Family reworded endorsement 44 to exactly the words that this court said would be sufficiently clear. And we did that after the Vidmar case came out.
Is there any issue between you and opposing counsel at this point that endorsement 44 is ambiguous?
No. Public policy also favors endorsement 44 becoming valid. Public policy favors freedom of contract and construction of insurance policies in accordance with their terms. This court in Limpert versus Smith stated that an insurer should not be bound by a risk it was unwilling to cover and for which it was not paid. An insurer should not be able to obtain insurance based on small, average-sized risks, but then obtain high-risk coverage. which are clearly contrary to the terms of the policy. American Family did provide coverage to Ms. Blazekonik for her two personal autos. It was very clear at the time that she would not have coverage for a fire truck that she was occupying in the course of her employment. Ms. Blazekonik had two other means of compensation, workers' compensation, and as a first-class city employee, she was given $25,000 from the city. If the legislature felt that she was unfairly compensated, they could mandate that private insurers provide coverage for high-risk vehicles, just as they do for people with unacceptable driving records, and private insurance has to provide them with coverage. It's the legislature's job to determine whether an individual is adequately compensated. If she's not adequately compensated, then maybe they need to go back and give more money. But she did obtain two layers of compensation without even considering the compensation she's looking for from American Family.
Could I ask one question? On 5E, talks about other applicable law in addition to subsection 6. Can you give an example of other applicable law?
Other applicable law would be both statutes and case law.
Can you think of anything?
No. The case law has been overturned. This court noted it in Clark that the case law was all overturned. There's no other cases that should be applied. Mr. Elliott and all previous briefs have relied upon Welch versus State Farm and Neiman. Those seem to be the two cases of issue. Those were noted to be overturned. Even if this court decided today that its notes in Clark were mere dicta, if you look at the statutes and you look at the cases, they're irreconcilable. You cannot state that Welch is still good law when you look at 5F, which states you can only obtain one insurance policy. They obtained two in that case. They'd be precluded from doing that. So just factually, this court now has the opportunity to go back and say, we clear it up. Yes, this is a binding decision. All these cases are overturned. And it's not just me believing that these cases have been overturned. There's been this court acknowledged in a footnote in Hull, as well as two other court of appeals, have also stated. They didn't say this is mere dicta. They kind of just left it.
What cases do sub G, H, and I address?
G deals specifically with St. Paul Mercury versus Zastro, which is a pedestrian case that deals with UM coverage. Section H, I don't believe there's a case in any of the Clark notations that would apply to H. I specifically is a Nicholson versus Home Insurance Company case because that's a true reducing clause case. Halsey applies to both F and J. Certainly, Neiman versus Badger Mutual would apply to both I and J because Neiman both discussed reducing clauses and regular use exclusions. So all of them break it down. There are different sections, statutes, which clearly overturn that case law.
You're not really relying on the footnotes. You just go back and look at the cases and the sections you say they're gone.
Exactly. We have this
Court of Appeals case.
Right. And we've disagreed, obviously, is it holding or dicta, but honestly, if you look at the wording of the statutes and the cases, they can't be reconciled.
It's dicta because those statutes were not in effect at the time of Clark. I mean, that's the argument.
Exactly. I mean, you could argue this court took up the issue, but was it germane in Clark? Probably not. But again, this court took it upon itself to almost guide litigants as to where the law was going.
That's what happens when you volunteer, right? Thank you.
Could I ask one question? The accident took place on August 25th, 1995.
Yes.
The endorsements were effective August 24th and 25th, according to the documents here. What if this accident occurred on August 20th, 1995?
Actually, I have to disagree, and I could certainly produce more documents to this court to ensure the court that these endorsements were valid years before this accident occurred. I'm not sure if possibly when a policy is renewed, sometimes it might say effective on a certain date, but as when the law changed in July 15th, 1995, endorsement 44 was attached to both of her policies. There should be no issue as to that. So even if the accident happened in August 20th of 1995, the predecessor attachment to what you're looking at right now would have been attached to her policies and would preclude UM coverage.
But in endorsement 44 has never been the subject of any case at this point.
Yes, it was, in Vidmar.
But you answered that of Justice Cook.
Yes.
I said that it was with respect to a different issue.
It was endorsement 44, but it dealt with a different issue. It dealt with, does UM coverage fall within the scope of endorsement 44? And this court read it and said it's ambiguous.
I'm not trying to put words into your mouth, Counsel, but I take it if, in fact, an argument were raised that this was an unconstitutional taking, or, you know, something unconstitutional because they had, had a right that was taken away from them by the legislature, your argument, I presume, would be she never had that right. That endorsement 44 is and always was effective.
Yes. There is a case, and I'm drawing a blank at the moment, it's Rowell versus American Family. Excuse me. In that particular case, 5J was discussed. It's a 5J case, but the issue before the court was it unconstitutional for American Family to still apply endorsement 44 when the law had just recently changed and she never had notice of the law change? And the Court of Appeals said there's statute 631 something that states that an insurance company cannot renew a policy on less favorable terms without giving notice to the insured. So the insured in that case said we were not given notice, and now the policy is definitely on less favorable terms. But the court in that particular case said the less favorable terms must be when the insurer changes a policy on less favorable terms. And the creation of Act 21, specifically 5J, was a legislative act. And even if it was a judicial act, you still don't have to provide notice to your insured because the law changes all the time. And yes, endorsement 44 had been attached to Ms. Blazikovic's policy for quite a period of time before endorsement 44 was valid. That kind of covers the fact that the law seems to change back and forth, and we don't have to give notice all the time as to the changing law when it's outside of the insurer's control.
If in 1993 she wanted to get rid of endorsement 44, what would have happened?
I'm not sure. Since it wasn't even valid, I'm not sure what the insurer would have done. I do not know what her agent would have done. More than likely, I would assume American Family would reserve its right to keep it attached to the policy in case endorsement 44 did become valid. Because if it wasn't attached, there really would be no argument that she did not have notice of endorsement 44, even if it did become valid.
What do you mean it wasn't valid?
Before July 1995, American Family would never have pressed the point that it was valid because Welch versus State Farm and other case law would have just invalidated based on the rationale that once you purchase it, you have it under all circumstances.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. Elliott.
Good morning, Justice. My name is Bob Elliott, and I represent Monica Blazikovic, the plaintiff respondent. It is our position that insofar as the Welch Neiman line of cases dealt with the invalidity of drive other car exclusions in the context of uninsured motorist coverage, those opinions have been replaced by the 1995 Act. But I emphasize the word replaced. They haven't. Those cases and the issues that the various courts decided in those cases weren't simply voided without being replaced by something. They were replaced by subsection J, which is, and I don't mean to speak for Justice Babbage's footnote in the Clark case or Judge Nettesheim in the Rail case, but I think both of those cases make it clear that that is what both courts have determined, that line of cases, insofar as they deal with drive other car exclusions and uninsured motorist coverage, have been replaced by sub J, which means that you then look at the 5J to determine whether or not an exclusion is allowable, that is, drive other car exclusions and uninsured motorist coverage. In this case, American Families exclusion does not fit A, does not fit 5J, but the facts of this case don't fit the requirements of 5J, primarily the first requirement, and that is that the insured own the vehicle or have a spouse that owns the vehicle that was being used by the insured at the time of the injury. I think one of the things that we all struggle with, and I think the court has struggled with, is how do you justify or how do you coordinate E of 5 and 5J and 6, and I think it's important to understand that those were all chronologically not passed at the same time. E existed and subsection 6 existed before change in the law in 1995, and it was because of part of the tort reform that the legislature enacted in 1995 that subsection 5 and the subsections we're dealing with here were engrafted onto the statutory scheme that already existed. Therefore, we believe that the term other applicable law in subsection E of 5 refers to, as I think Counsel for American Family has conceded, refers to other statutory law, and here it refers to J. Very simply, as the trial court found and as the Court of Appeals found, American Family, in the factual circumstance here, the exclusion cannot apply because it cannot satisfy subparagraph 1 of J, and that is the insured owner of the vehicle. At the beginning of American Family's argument, they used the term regular use as opposed to drive other car. I assume that American Family means we're really dealing with the same kind of idea here, and that is an exclusion which, and I think rightly so, insurers try to prevent their insurance being exposed to injury using a car that the insurance company doesn't know about. This is J does not, and the entire Act 1995 does not give carte blanche to the insurance industry to insert any kind of drive other car exclusions. I think, again, it was the legislative balance. On the one hand, the prior history of uninsured motors being a very protected coverage for insureds in the state of Wisconsin, and on the other hand, wanting to allow insurers to have some relief for valid drive other car exclusion. If they had intended to have all drive other car exclusion be allowed, then I think there would be no purpose to for the legislature to pass J at all. So that, in long and in short, is the plaintiff's position here. We believe the Court of Appeals is correct in determining that simply factually, because Ms. Blazkowicz obviously did not own this fire engine in question, nor did her spouse or anyone living with her own the fire engine in question, that the exclusion, endorsement 44, does not satisfy the requirements of sub J, the first subparagraph 1.
How about sub 2?
It does satisfy that, Your Honor, but if the sub J says that all of sub 1, 2, and 3 have to be satisfied. It would satisfy 2, and it certainly would satisfy 3, but it does not satisfy 1. That's the fatal defect, we believe. Frankly, I don't wish to belabor the argument. I think I've made my point. If you wish to make, I'd be happy to answer any questions the court has.
Your position is it's just not covered under J?
Our position is that the J applies. You have to weigh this exclusion, endorsement 44, in the light of J and the factual circumstances. And here, the factual circumstance is that the insurer does not own the vehicle, and therefore it does not valid under J.
Is there any other statute that prohibits this?
Endorsement 44?
Well,
I don't believe so. However, there's certainly the Welsh versus Neiman case law would prohibit it were it not for J. Had J not been promulgated by the legislature, I think the Welsh to Neiman case line of cases would still be valid and would prohibit this and all other drive of car exclusions in an uninsured motorist coverage. J opens the door a bit for insurance companies, but it doesn't open it entirely to all drive of car exclusions.
So your position basically is that anything that's not listed in the statute as permitted is prohibited?
For drive other car exclusions and uninsured motorist coverage.
And how does that square with sub E?
Well, sub E existed before J before the 1995 legislature, but it squares with it in the term other applicable law at the end of the first sentence in sub E. The other applicable law that prohibits exclusions is J, in the sense that in the context of the case law that also existed before J, the Welch and Neiman line of cases, which prohibited all drive other car exclusions. If you take that body of law and you determine that that body of law has been replaced, but it has been replaced with J, and only in a permissive sense, that J states, articulates what drive other car exclusions are allowed. I think it's similar to saying a speed limit sign says you may go 25 miles an hour. It doesn't say you can't go over 25 miles an hour, but that doesn't mean that you can go over 25 miles an hour just simply because the law doesn't prohibit it. The law is stating what the limit is and what's allowable in that instance, and that may not be a perfect analogy. Analogies are always dangerous, but that's our point, that without J, had J not been promulgated, all the Welch versus Neiman case law would still be valid law and would prohibit all drive of the car exclusions, including endorsement 44.
Counsel, how do you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that following your interpretation will just open up a big loophole for a myriad of other exclusions, and the legislature couldn't have intended that? That's absurd to think that that's what they're trying to accomplish.
Well,
that's the argument.
I think we have to start with the fact that there were no drive-of-the-car exclusions allowed in the context of uninsured motorist coverage. We haven't had the opportunity to address the infinitesimal number of exclusions that might apply to liability coverage or any other coverage that we might have under our automobile insurance policies. I mean, certainly there are all kinds of exclusions that are, and there are exclusions that are not allowed under liability coverage, medical pay coverage, other kinds of collision coverage, and what have you. What we focused on, and I think the only issues we've addressed to the court, are in the context of uninsured motorist coverage. And if we were to, I think one of the arguments made by American Family in this reply brief is that if you utilize J to say that you can't have exclusions in liability coverage or medical pay coverage, I think if I were to make that argument, in the case of American Family, it would be the first to point out to me that, first of all, J is in the uninsured motorist provisions or part of section of Chapter 632. And secondly, the legislative history makes it very clear that this subsection J was directed towards drive other car exclusions in the uninsured motorist context. I think that's the natural stopping point, if you will, to this argument that, well, you would open the door to unlimited problems here. Now, I suppose I can imagine other arguments that might be made in another context, and if that issue had been fully briefed, I might have a better answer for it.
How do you deal with E? A policy may provide for exclusions not prohibited by sub 6. Now you're arguing that doesn't fall under 6, right?
Yes, it does not. You're correct.
Therefore, it's not prohibited?
No, you have to complete the sentence. It says not prohibited by 6 or other applicable law.
Right, so what's your other applicable law?
The other applicable law, which prior to July of 95, I would have said, is the Welch Neiman line of cases. And since then, I think it is that line of cases as it's been replaced by by J.
Okay.
Now, is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision you don't like that you would think we can improve on, other than and you agree with the result?
Well, since they said they liked all of my arguments, I guess I wouldn't say that. I don't think that.
Just checking.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Lawyer Ryan.
I only have a few quick points. Mr. Elliott discusses the LRB's analysis and states it deals with UM driver-of-the-car exclusions. It's true, driver-of-the-car exclusions is listed as the LRB as the focus of 5J. However, it doesn't say UM. But most importantly, it says driver-of-the-car exclusions which have been invalidated. That makes perfect sense in light of the other statutes that were created under 5E. 5F, G, H all validate previously invalidated anti-stacking clauses. I validates previously invalidated reducing clauses. And J validates previously invalidated drive other car exclusions. All of those statutory provisions work together, kind of a scheme of allowing anti-stacking clauses. In this case, in Welch versus State Farm, for example, it was really drive other car exclusion, was the exclusion that the insurance company attempted to void coverage. But it was treated as an anti-stacking case because ultimately the insurer did not want to stack both policies that the insured had. So all of these work together to either prevent an insured from obtaining any coverage or being limited to one.
Well, maybe the legislature considered everything, but they drafted it as they did. And it said that under J, in order to qualify, you must meet all of the following conditions. And counsel for the plaintiff here says you clearly don't meet subsection 1.
It doesn't.
Okay.
But again, it was never intended to address endorsement 44. It was intended to address the type of driver their car exclusions which had been invalidated. And again, those are the situations where you have an insured insuring only one of many cars, yet expecting coverage under one of the cars that wasn't driving a car that was not insured, but expecting coverage under the one car they had insurance.
But under the plain language of the statute, you've got a compelling argument.
Under the plain language of the statute, it doesn't say driver their car exclusions, and it doesn't say UM coverage. It says losses arising out of the use of a motor vehicle. Now, neither Mr. Elliott nor I have really argued it's ambiguous, but the Court of Appeals, I'm not going to say guessed, but assumed that we're talking about driver the car exclusions. The purpose of this court is to discern the legislative intent. I don't want to argue it's ambiguous, but Mr. Elliott did attach the LRB's analysis. It does say driver the car exclusions. It says only those that were invalidated. So that is the only piece of history we have to really say what were the intending of 5J. Because if you just look at the word the 5J, it's opening the door to any liability exclusion, any med pay exclusion, any. It doesn't meet these situations, one, two, or three. It's invalid. And that is going to lead to absurd results.
Well,
because
can you give us some of those absurd results?
Sure, intentional act exclusions, punitive damages exclusions. Any time an insured is driving a vehicle that would be unowned, but the insured is driving and they shoot out a car window, they might have coverage. Liability exclusions in the past, driver the car exclusions, have always been held valid. But if it doesn't meet these criteria, which are very narrow, they're going to be invalid. And again, if you look at all statutory provisions, they really only deal with validating UM exclusions. Even though this doesn't say UM, it says what has been previously invalidated. Only UM exclusions have ever been really the subject of invalidation by courts.
Well, looking specifically at subject, what language do you want us to implicitly put into sub J so as to bring you within the ambit of
nothing? The fact that it doesn't say anything is prohibited means that it's permitted. 5E, Mr. Elliott's right, 5E was in existence before 5J was drafted. If they wanted to change the law and only those statutes that specifically permit exclusions are permitted, they would have gotten rid of 5E. Because 5E just somewhat allows the legislature to say, this is going to be permitted unless prohibited. If they didn't want that anymore, they would have gotten rid of it. 5E is there for a reason. I understand the facts of Clark occurred before the enactment of 1995, but the court did rather extensively note how the new law would change, and it didn't state that 5E would be superfluous under the new law. You don't look at 5E under the new law. You go right to a specific statute. So 5J is permissible. Right on its face, it's not prohibited. And my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
What specific language would you point to from the 1995 Act that reversed the effectiveness of endorsement 44?
Endorsement 44 would be invalid because of case law. Specifically, Welch led to many cases citing the same language, which was, once an insured purchases uninsured motorist coverage, they have uninsured motorist coverage under all circumstances. And it went on to cite, you have it on horseback, you have it on a pogo stick. That is no longer good law, because now an insured, if they are driving a vehicle that's uninsured, they don't have any coverage at all. Personal and portable is rather difficult. But what the statutory provisions, F through I, appear to do, is putting UM insurance back to the vehicle you're driving. The exception is 5G, which does allow a person to obtain UM coverage when they're outside of a motor vehicle, such as a pedestrian. Under those circumstances, it's personal and portable to attach to one policy. But what F through J does, except for G, says whatever car you're in at the time, that's the car you're going to have insurance, UM insurance. And before that, UM coverage had been personal and portable. Wherever you were, it was going to attach to a different vehicle.
So, as I understand, if I'm a pedestrian and I'm stuck on an uninsured vehicle, now, if you have that exclusion in the policy, I don't have coverage.
Oh, no, you do have coverage. G specifically states that you will have coverage under the highest single limit policy you have, but only one policy. Before 1995,
No stacking.
No stacking.
I'm on a pogo stick, and I can't find it.
You no longer will have coverage.
I'm on a pogo stick, right?
Right.
I will no longer have coverage if I'm on a pogo stick?
No. I believe you will have coverage.
Am I really uninsured motor vehicle?
Yes, you will have it on the pogo stick still, or on the horseback, or whatever.
Thank you.
Well, I drafted those words, and I don't want them to disappear.
Thank you, Ms. Moya Ryan. Thank you, Ms. Elliott. That concludes our hearing on 98 Day.